We're all presidents, we're all congressmen, we're all cops and waiting. We're the workers of the world. There is the elite and the dispossessed, and it's only about survival. Who has skill to play the game for all it's worth? Reaching out, scared kind of perfection. Let's try and keep as much emotion.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Chris Hedges, who's a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He previously spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times, where in 2002, he was part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism. He also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights and is the author of the bestsellers War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascists, Empire of Illusion, and Death of the Liberal Class. His latest book just out is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Hedges.
Thank you, Ian.
And Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which is illustrated by Joe Sacco. This book is a kind of a warning of a coming, a kind of an American dystopia. How, in fact, you know, going beyond the obvious questions of are we still a democracy? Have we become an oligarchy? And are we indeed heading into a kind of plantation economy? Some of the places that you covered, for example, in Welsh West Virginia, Days of Devastation, my understanding is that wasn't that where they filmed that dystopian teenage film that came out? What was it called? The Hunters or the...
I didn't even hear that. I don't know.
Anyway, I don't mean to confuse you, but in other words, there's a combination of in the popular culture, a sense of dystopia, and you've really experienced it and documented the real dystopia.
Well, you know, there are always sacrifice zones, these areas that are exploited without any kind of regulation or protection, such as the coal fields of southern West Virginia, these dead enclaves in inner cities like Camden. Camden is a chapter which per capita is the poorest city in the United States. It produces virtually nothing. It was at one point a manufacturing center. And the point of the book, although it is a heavily reported book, is that these sacrifice zones are just spreading outwards now that there is no impediment at all to corporate capitalism. They are in the process rapidly reconfiguring the country into a form of neo-feudalism. And we went to the epicenters where it started to give people a glimpse of what awaits them if this corporate coup d'etat is not reversed. Karl Marx was right in that sense. Unfettered capitalism is a revolutionary force. It commodifies everything. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that it then exploits until exhaustion or collapse. And we tried to do that by telling the stories of the first victims, the people who are the precursors to what awaits the rest of us. And this book is more than illustrated by Sacco. There's 50 pages of drawings, but a lot of them, as you know, are comic panels. So it will actually... and often the most poignant personal narratives flip into panels that not only have their quotes but illustrate their suffering, their lives, and what they've endured. And I think it gives the book a kind of punch.
And the chapters in the book, Days of Theft, Pine Ridge in South Dakota, Days of Siege, Camden, New Jersey, Days of Devastation, Welsh, West Virginia, Days of Slavery, Immokalee, Florida, and Days of Revolt, Liberty Square, New York. Again, the brand new book by Chris Hedges, illustrated by Joe Sacco, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. I was trying to think of the name of the movie. It was called The Hunger Games, and it was based on a huge bestseller and it became one of the biggest hits, movie hits of the year. And neither you or I have seen it, Chris, but the point about it is that that somehow out there in the zeitgeist, and particularly amongst the young, we're talking about this appeal to the 20-year-olds and younger. This sense of decay, of a kind of looming dystopia here in the United States, and you know, and the destruction of the American dream, which of course is being marketed now by the two politicians that are running. And I find it absolutely astounding that after what happened on Wall Street in 2008, that the 1% could have the hubris to run a candidate who is the poster boy of the 1%. And you know, I think Romney's got a very good chance of being elected.
Well, as you may know, I think they both serve the interests of the 1%, you know, pretty assiduously, you know, especially this announcement now that in terms of expanding drilling in the Arctic wildlife refuge, you know, I think the problem is that power lies now, and this was the brilliance of Occupy Wall Street, not in Washington. These people are corporate employees, but on Wall Street itself. And you walk into these sacrifice zones, and you see what happens to human beings when you are blowing the top 400 feet off of mountains, the violence that does to communities, to families, to personal dignity, to self-esteem, the substance abuse, the breakdown in relations, both within the family, within the community, the despair, the high suicide rates. I mean, you go to Pine Ridge, South Dakota, the average life expectancy of a male is 48 years old. That is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. By the time you get to Immokalee, Florida, our produce fields, and in, as Bernie Sanders has pointed out, in the race to the bottom, Immokalee is the bottom, you actually replicate slavery, i.e. people are held against their will, forced to work without wages. It is just a staggering window into what corporations that have no impediments will do to human beings. And if we don't wake up, then we are going to replicate the power structure of George Orwell's 1984, where you have a tiny inner party circle of 3-4%, an outer party circle of managers of about 12%, and the rest of us are going to be proles. That's where we're headed.
Well, I think, though, that given what's happening in Europe with Merkel basically unable to deal with the euro crisis, and it's likely to cascade over here, and given the elections in this country are ruled on the apparently by the basis of it's the economy, stupid, I would say that even if there's not much difference between the two candidates, that a President Romney would be the ultimate culmination of the corporatization of America. I mean, he is a corporate CEO, and he would run the country like a corporation. And
I think that in terms of policies, there's very little daylight between Romney and Obama, and you can take Obamacare. Obamacare was formulated by the Heritage Foundation, first put into practice in 2006 when Romney was governor of Massachusetts, and then adopted by the Obama administration after the pharmaceutical and insurance industries wrote in $447 billion in subsidies, the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industry, and then passed it. And I think that when we look at legislation, whether it is the prosecution of imperial wars, the failure to register Wall Street, Obama's record on civil liberties is actually worse than George Bush's, and I sued him and won, amazingly, for the National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1021, which allows U.S. citizens to be arrested by the military and held without due process. You know, I think we have to look at what they do and not what they say. In terms of human beings, you're right. I mean, Obama is a more palatable figure, but I think structurally we are headed, a kind of a corporate oligarchic feudalism, and I don't think either Obama or Romney are going to do much to stop it.
Well, you've done something to stop it, and tell us about what you did in terms of the case that you brought forward.
Well, this was, I sued Barack Obama and Leon Panetta. It made it to federal court, and the judge, Catherine Forrest, actually ruled in our favor. We have heard that the government intends to appeal it, but she ruled that this was, that we were credible plaintiffs, and that this was an unconstitutional law and she issued a temporary injunction invalidating it. It was really a remarkable ruling. But I think that on so many levels, including the Espionage Act, which Obama has used six times to stop whistleblowers and leakers, we have seen this president, actually tighten the stranglehold that was begun by George Bush, and he hasn't even restored habeas corpus, the FISA Amendment Act. It's quite terrifying when we ignore the personal narratives of candidates, and I think that political philosophers like Sheldon Wolin or earlier Benjamin DeMott pointed all of this out, that the political, the narratives of these candidates is irrelevant to where political and economic power lies, and it really lies out of their hands. It lies at this point in the hands of the corporate oligarchy, and if Obama doesn't dance to their tunes, he's finished. Romney, of course, dances to their tunes and always has, and that's why the end of the book is Days of Revolt, that the only credible chance that we have for a systematic change will come through mass protests and civil disobedience, and we all need to look up what's happening in Quebec with those students who pulled 250,000 people into the streets when they tried to pass laws which mirror the laws that Rahm Emanuel put in place in Chicago and that the corporate state is trying to cement to prevent legitimate dissent, to in essence criminalize legitimate dissent. It's all part of the same system. And unfortunately, there's only one way we're going to effectively change it, and it's not by voting.
Well, it feels like, I've been talking about the country being a plutonomy ruled by oligarchs now for some years, and people thought it was a kind of becoming a broken record. But then the 99% movement came along and put that front and center in the national consciousness. And I suppose if you take the analogy of the Alcoholics Anonymous, where the first thing you have to admit is that you're an alcoholic. And in this case, the first thing I think we have to admit is that we're no longer a democracy. Now we've got to take some extra steps. So where are we in terms of the steps towards doing what's actually in the preamble to the Constitution, that when a government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to overturn it and replace it?
Well, we have watched essentially the counter-revolution. That's what the state has unleashed by shutting down in coordination and a coordinated effort the 18 occupying encampments and then sort of slowly picking off the rest. And it's not just external repression. We know that they have devoted tremendous resources to infiltrating these movements and trying to fragment, destroy them, splinter them. And it's certainly hurt the Occupy movement. But all of the issues that drove people into these encampments, the long-term unemployment, the student debt, the failure to address the bank repossessions and foreclosures, are still there and getting worse. And especially now as we begin to push through these austerity programs where the most basic services to those who are most distressed within our society are being cut or eliminated. It means this movement isn't going to go away. How will it reconfigure itself? How will it manifest itself? I don't know. No one knows. Even the people closest to these movements don't know. I've covered movements, the revolutions in Eastern Europe, the Palestinian uprisings or Intifada, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, and these movements have a kind of life, power, almost mystical force of their own. But I believe that they're still there, bubbling beneath the surface of the society, ready to erupt. And I think that the security and surveillance state agrees with me, which is why they are rapidly pushing through legal mechanisms by which they can carry out draconian forms of repression. Joe and I spent months in these places because we wanted to put a human face on what's happening. It's not a book of rhetoric. It's not a book of theory. It's a book where the pain is palpable and real, and the cruelty and force of destruction that is embodied in the corporate state is quite literally made visible not only in the writing, but in the illustrations and comic panels that Sacco has contributed to the book, and I think, you know, for that reason, deeply enriched the book. The people who live with this kind of misery in our society because of the corporate media have been rendered virtually invisible, and the goal was to make them visible as a kind of flashing red light, a warning for what's about to happen to the rest of us. And I think, you know, I'm a huge admirer of Joe Sacco, as I think anyone who knows his work is. It's a unique kind of project. We've not married those two forms of narrative journalism and graphic journalism, and I think it really works. You know, I mean, I spent 20 years as abroad as a foreign correspondent, and I can't tell you how many elections I covered in dictatorships, whether it was Syria or Pinochet's Chile, or Iran or anywhere else. And it is an effective way to siphon off energy into a really futile exercise, and I would argue that's where we are today. I'll vote, but I'm not going to waste any emotional or intellectual energy on this campaign, on who said what. I will pull a lever. I won't vote for Obama, and I won't vote for Romney at this point. It's a vote of defiance. That's either Green or Rocky Anderson or none of the above, and then get back out where we belong, which is in the street. Take a look at what's happening in Quebec. They pulled a quarter of a million people.
Amazing.
Once we can begin to, on a steady basis, pull those kinds of numbers, it's important that we remain nonviolent, because the object, the power structure is so rotten, and so corroded and so corrupt, that the idea is to draw those forces, especially the foot soldiers, over to our side and create paralysis within those structures of power. And I think that's possible. I think that this corporate oligarchic criminal class has just overstepped their bounds. They've gone too far. And I think they're very vulnerable, and I think we see it in how frightened they became of the Occupy movement.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Chris Hedges.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Hedges as a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He previously spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times, where in 2002 he was part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism. He also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights and is the author of the bestsellers War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascists, Empire of Illusion, and Death of the Liberal Class. His latest book just out is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Christian Vasquez and Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.